Good morning, everyone. My name is Nayaswami Riman, and my wife Padma. We're from Seattle. But we each have, in our own way, before coming to Ananda in Nevada County years ago, we both have our own personal connections with this area. I went to Santa Clara University down the street, as it were, and was born and raised in Monterey and Pacific Grove, golf capital of the world. I was a terrible golfer, but I enjoyed, you know, fly fishing and golfing are, in prior generations, at least men's way of meditating. And I loved the green grass, the ocean, and so forth. I could barely hit the ball. But mostly I was a caddy in my younger years and got to meet some very interesting people. One of the very first lessons that I garnered from that experience, however, that has served me well in my life, is I was told as a cat, I had to learn the rules, you know, for catting and so on. And we were told that you should always play the ball where it lies. And although I'm not a card player, Padma is a vicious card player, but I could at least say that we have to play the hand that we're dealt in life. We've been studying in Seattle in a course, class series right now, and so it's fresh on my mind, the Mahabharata and, of course, the Bhagavad Gita. And interesting that the inner kingdom of our mind and of the astral anatomy and meditation, which is the essence of the path of self-realization, and yet Krishna's counsel is to take action, to stand up, and fight the battle of life. Any of you ever see that movie? I don't necessarily recommend it. It's not all that good, but it was a worthy effort. The Legend of Bagger Vance. It's a golfing story, right? Okay. And Will Smith plays the caddy. He just shows up out of nowhere, and he coaches Arjun, the golfer who has some issues and some problems, and counsels him to become a winner, as it were. Well, so in golf, there's a lot to golf that you should really meditate on. But the call to action, and when we think of truthfulness, the affirmation today, our religion is measured in the cold light of day, and we have to play the ball of life where it lies. And so it is. I gave a talk recently, and I don't know why this came to me, but the life of Robert E. Lee came to me. This was a great and noble man, by all accounts, but he chose, as we know, the wrong side. Loyalty, the first chakra, one of the positive qualities of the first chakra. He played the game of life where the ball lay, and it lay in Virginia. And so, though he was offered the leadership of the Union Army before the war broke out, he declined, and of course led the Confederacy at one point. And so it is. Sometimes the hand of cards that we're dealt or the ball that lies on the ground of our life, we just have to play that game. And I think of the great story, because we've been studying the Mahabharata, the story I wanted to use today was the semi-tragic story of Karna in the Mahabharata, a tragic figure, just like out of the Greek stories, who had to do what he had to do, and he made mistakes, and yet was a noble person. And yet the story didn't end well. Karna, you see, was born to an unwed teenage mother, something I know something about, but I'm not going to tell you that story. And so his mother, to escape humiliation, like the mother of Moses, set him in a basket and set him adrift down what became the Ganges. And if you know the story, he was found, and he was found by a wife of a charioteer. And owing to his patrimony, if that's the word, he was a great warrior. In fact, the Mahabharata strongly suggests he was greater even than Arjuna, the greatest of all warriors. But he chose the wrong side. As he grew up, being identified and assumed to be the son of merely a charioteer, though he was of great noble birth, essentially, sort of like the king, pauper, and the prince. He was ridiculed and bullied and so forth, and so he developed this thing where he wanted respect, he wanted fame, he wanted acknowledgement. And so though he was a great warrior, in various competitions when he became an adult, he was shunned. And that just increased his desire. He had a prayerful life. He performed his sadhana and so forth. He worshipped this god as Surya, which in fact in the longer story that I'm not going to tell was his father. Nonetheless, he was a dharmic man in his own right. But the one who gave him what he desired, the acknowledgement, was the great evil of the story, Duryodhana. And so he, because he was given a kingdom and therefore became royalty, though in truth he was royalty but didn't know it, like the pauper and the prince, he was then given, or he gave rather, to Duryodhana his life, his loyalty. Loyalty is the first law of God, as I said, in the first chakra. And sometimes the game of life that we play, we have to fight it, we have to play it, we have to swing the club as it is in our life. And so Karna, in order to support Duryodhana, did many shameful things, hateful things, a warmonger. He humiliated Draupadi, the wife of the Pandavas, the good guys. For all of these things, he was going to pay the price. And yet, whenever he was asked for anything, he gave generously, noble. And that too was his downfall, because he was tricked. And I think he knew he was being tricked. But just like Yudhisthira, who played the game of dice knowing he was going to be tricked, but fulfilled what he perceived to be his dharma, so it was Karna allowed himself to be tricked and lost his weapons, essentially, in the war. It's a strange story, the Mahabharata, because we have the good guys and the bad guys, don't we? But on the side of the good guys is Krishna, representing the highest dharma. But among these good guys and these bad guys, just like you and I, each have their various qualities, some good, some bad. It's not black and white, the world that we live in. And yet we have to follow our dharma as we see it. One of the great lessons of the Mahabharata and of the Bhagavad Gita taught by Krishna is that we cannot really know ahead of time whether the choices we make are the right ones. It seems cruel, doesn't it? It's only in the consequences of our actions can we see the results and whether they are positive or negative, spiritually or materially, depending what they are. And so it is, Karna commits himself to this war. Prior to the war, Krishna comes to him and reveals to him who he really is, that in fact, he is the eldest brother of the good guys, the Pandavas, and that should he acknowledge his patrimony, he would become the emperor of the kingdom, and the other brothers who he had sworn to fight would then not only be his brothers, but his subjects. Out of loyalty to Duryodhana, his friend, though he represented a dharma, the wrong side, he chose to remain. And then Krishna sent his own mother, his real mother, who is the mother of some of the other Pandavas. They're all half-brothers, therefore. She revealed herself to him, but he rejected her. He said to her, "You sent me away as a baby. I was adopted and loved by these other two people, this couple, the charioteer and his wife, and it is to them that I owe my loyalty, my love." And so it is that the story had to go on. And so it is that with each of these stages of his story, he was finally slain on the battlefield near the end of the 18 days war. In fact, it was ignoble in some ways. His chariot got stuck in the mud or on the field, and according to the rules of engagement of warfare in those days, it was like time out on the basketball field. And so he got off his chariot to fix the wheel, and Krishna, of all people, says to Arjuna, kill him. Because Karna had vowed to kill Arjuna. And at that moment, then, he himself died. And so we see in the great story of life, this is a big drama, bigger than any of us, but when we look at the choices we have made, we do the best we can, but we cannot know the result. And whether or not we choose the good side or the bad side, it's very difficult to know. Without the flame of meditation, without a connection to the stillness, to hear the voice of Krishna, so to speak, we cannot as easily make that right choice. But sometimes our commitment, sometimes the choices we make, the loyalties, and Karna, by the way, represented psychologically, spiritually, attachment. He was attached to his loyalty to Duryodhana. He was attached to the parents. Are those bad things? Well, not really. Loyalty is the first law of success. Loyalty is the first law of God. But you see how that clinging, the attachment to what he thought was a spiritual principle, was effectively his undoing. We see in our center, I'm sure it's true everywhere, because after all, this path of self-realization is not exactly the Baptist church. We see that among our couples in our Sangha, there's one of the two who are involved on this path, and the other typically is not. I can think of a number of instances, but the one I have in my mind is an instance in where this one man who is a sincere devotee, Kriyaban, etc., out of loyalty to his wife, who I think must have been somewhat high-born, as they say, and maybe in a wealthy family, I don't totally know the circumstances, very conservative. I won't indicate the political party to which that might be attached, but nonetheless, very conservative, to whom his appearance in such a goofy place as Ananda would be shunned, would be frowned upon by her peers. And so out of respect for loyalty to his wife, he doesn't come. Well, working with him for some time as I did, I being who I am, finally told him what I thought about that. Haven't seen him since. But is it right? Is it not right? I can't honestly say. I wanted to encourage him to be a little bit more courageous about his path and not such a spineless person in my point of view, but I can't really honestly say what the karma is between he and his wife and why the level of what I suppose he would call his respect for her wishes that prevents him from satsang and coming together. Life is not that simple, you see. And that's one of the great things about the Mahabharata that I love so much is the nuanced recognition that life is filled with difficult choices. And when we make those choices, how many times, I mean, what's the obvious choice that of life that we see day in and day out? It's the choice of marriage, isn't it? You go to the altar, you might think you know that it's all about. It doesn't work out. You might go to the altar in fear and trepidation with lots of reservations, and it works out. You don't know. You can only do the best you can for who you are. That's all we really have. And if we can deepen that attunement to the divine will, of course. But nonetheless, we will have to play that game of life the way we find it, the way it comes to us. Our teachings tell us that we created that, but we don't really know that. The best we can do is accept it as ours and leave it at that, and accept it, embrace it, and live it the best we can. And there it is. Truthfulness is to face with what Swamiji, I like this expression, he said, with ruthless self-honesty, as it said in the affirmation reading. Ruthless self-honesty about my motives and what I'm doing. And even if I'm attached to a particular outcome, but I can't help myself to stand up for this cause or desire this thing or this person, whatever it may be, we can at least be honest. The phrase in yoga that I remember Swamiji saying that stuck with me, has stuck with me all my life. Awareness, three words. Awareness precedes control. Until we can be aware of our attachments, our desires and our fears, we have no control over them. And that's where wit begins. Mindfulness through meditation, prayer and devotion, purification. None of that. I remember one time being together later years with Swamiji, and he looked out at all of us, and I guess it was a meditation or something, and he said something to the effect of, meditation, what good has it done any of you? And then we all just laughed, because life is not that easy. We don't change that quickly. We have to accept life as it comes to us and do the best we can with it. And we will make mistakes. And in the end, Krishna praised Karna after his death as a person of great nobility and dharma. He did the best he could with what he had.
Well, I'm just going to say a few words on today's subject of the inner kingdom. You know, in the yogic path, we often talk about the spiritual path being 3 feet long. You know, it's the spine, it's the inner life. And with Swami Kriyananda, I began to learn, and he would say sometimes, I heard him say it mostly towards the end of his life, that the spiritual path is really about 6 inches long. It's from the medulla to the spiritual eye. I heard him say several times that he could feel where on the spectrum from the medulla to the spiritual eye our ego resided, where we were in that pathway. And when I first heard him say that, I recalled that when he blessed Riemann and I, when he ordained us as light bearers, I hadn't seen him ever do that before or since, but what he did to the few of us who were blessed that day, he put one hand at the medulla and the other at the spiritual eye while he was blessing us. And it was a very powerful experience. It was just like he was trying to loosen that medulla and shoot it up. Shoot the ego up to the spiritual eye for us, give us a boost, you know, in that process. And so the kingdom is within, the spiritual life, the spiritual path, really everything in life is reflected from what is inside of us. And it's universal. Everyone's the same, you know, just as human beings, we're all shaped the same on the outside, we're all shaped the same on the inside. There's a little story that our friends at Ananda in Assisi told about when they built their temple of light and they created the spiritual eye for the altar in Venice. They went to find a glass blower there and they gave him a design of the spiritual eye, and this man who didn't know them from Adam, said, what is that? He said, I see that all the time. You know, he wasn't practicing meditation or this path, but these things are universal. These experiences are all within us. Riemann and I laughed years ago, I won't say how many years ago, when AARP started sending us magazines. There was an ad in there, and it was for Dome's pills. And it said, are you plagued by these sounds? And then it showed a harp, and it showed a bell, and it showed a drum, and it said, take Dome's pills, and it will help them go away, you know? It's universal. I mean, we may not recognize it. We may not be consciously on a spiritual path to tune into it, but the inner life is a universal life. And so, what is it that makes us not go within? You know, why are we hesitating? Why are we not there all the time? The image that came to my mind was the one that Swamiji used to love to tell about the people in Pakistan who were in a bus and it got stuck, and the bus driver asked them to all come out and help push, and they were pushing and pushing and pushing like crazy, and nothing was happening. And finally, he walked back a little bit and stood back to see why it was not happening, and half of the people were pushing one way and half the other. So of course, our karma, our desires, all these things, you know, prevent us from feeling like we're moving forward. On the spiritual path, when we practice karma yoga, Yogananda says that our love for God and our communion with God while we're in action has to be stronger than the action itself, has to be more powerful than the action itself. And so we try and we keep moving forward. When we were in India, and I think it was, we went many times to visit Swamiji there. I think this was the year that he was writing the Bhagavad Gita, and we were there around the time of the Diwali ceremony. And I think Asha was there, and David, and Jyotishin Devi, and a few others. And there's a lot of fireworks with Diwali. The reading this morning just reminded me of that. And so he said, let's go up to the roof and watch the fireworks there. And so the house was three stories, I think, and then from the third story, you could take this little circular staircase all the way up to the roof. And Reema and I were the last ones to go up, and Swami was the very last behind us. And he chuckled, and he said, this is just like Ram Gopal Muzumbar with Master. That experience. And at first I had to think for a minute, and of course he was talking about the inner fireworks, the inner light. Yogananda was seeking, for those of you who've read Autobiography of a Yogi, he was seeking to find enlightenment in the Himalayas and seeking for someone to help him to that end. And he got lost, it's a long story, but he ended up with Ram Gopal, and he was at his home, and Ram Gopal fed him, and he was supposed to go to sleep, and he couldn't sleep. And Ram Gopal knew that, and he teased him. He said, why aren't you sleeping? And he said, there's all this light inside of me, all this fireworks inside of me. How can I possibly sleep? You see, we don't see it. We live in an outer life. We live in shadows, you know, ranges of shadows. Within us, the Bhagavad Gita calls it, Krishna calls it, that God is like 1,000 suns. 1,000 suns, you know, just to give us an image of that. That's within us. That's the brightness within us. And yet, you know, we seek a place where there's a beach where we can go enjoy the sun, you know. The shadows of this outer world are all reflections from what's inside of us, but they're only partial reflections to the extent that we have freed ourselves in God, freed our consciousness in God to experience it. And so we might say, and I hear this all the time in our work, God wants me to be here. God wants me to be there. God wants me to do this. God wants me to be that. And I just say, the only thing God wants is for us to go within. Anything else, we're just, you know, sort of kidding ourselves. I remember one time we asked Swamiji, after the fire, we were living in town in Nevada City with a lot of other members because the housing hadn't been rebuilt yet. And we were feeling the pull, and many people were asking us to move back to the village. And we talked to him about it, and he said, you know, God doesn't care where you live. He just cares if you love him. And it was a perfect answer to what we were facing. And of course, we did move to the village. Back to the village, a house became available for us. But the point is, that's the only direction that we're taking is within. That's the only thing that the divine asks of us, to turn within. And then the entire universe opens up to us in bliss. Thank you.